Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the Politics Guys with your hosts, Jay Parson and Michael Baranowski.
Welcome to the Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My co-host this week, as always, is Cleveland area attorney and sometime Republican strategist Jay Carson. We start off today's show with what some say is a huge development in the presidential campaign. For most of the week, things seemed fairly sedate. Donald Trump made light of a porn star who accused him of making unwanted sexual advances. And also, Donald Trump ended all fundraising events. Hillary Clinton, who I think showed some great confidence in her commanding lead, she started helping out Democratic congressional candidates, even though the race was tightening at least somewhat. But then on Friday, FBI Director James Comey sent a brief and somewhat cryptic letter to a number of congressional committees in which he said, "In connection with an unrelated case, the FBI has learned of the existence of emails that appear to be pertinent to the investigation. I am writing to inform you that the investigative team briefed me on this yesterday, and I agreed that the FBI should take appropriate investigative steps designed to allow investigators to review these emails to determine whether they contain classified information, as well as to assess their importance to our investigation. Although the FBI cannot yet assess whether or not this material may be significant, and I cannot predict how long it will take us to complete this additional work, I believe it is important to update your committees about our efforts in light of my previous testimony." And then everybody completely freaked out. So what do you make of all this, Jay?
Well, you know, there's something there. There are two things. First of all, I think you want to take the context of Comey and what his job is and what his relationship with Congress is. I mean, he's testified before Congress about the investigation, about what they've done, and he has indicated he will keep them up to date. So he's got he does, I think, believe have a duty to let Congress know if he's found additional evidence that might impact the investigation. I think the letter is pretty cautiously worded. I obviously, given what I understand the volume to be, and my understanding is also that this is information that is came to light in light of the investigation of Anthony Weiner sexting a 15-year-old. it's not coming from the WikiLeaks stuff. It's coming out of that piece of this. They're taking the appropriate cautious step so that, first of all, Comey isn't, held in contempt of Congress, nor is there claims of, look, there was a cover up and here you knew all this and you didn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, none of us know what are in those emails or not. We might guess what's in some of them if it's Anthony Weiner's account
exactly.
They're looking at. But, it's a surprise, but I don't think this is sort of a prearranged systems rigged October surprise type situation. If it was, I think if the fix was in, so to speak, I think we would have seen an indictment or more pursuit of this back in the summer. It bears watching, but I think it's serious. It's serious enough. I mean, just based on what I understand to be the volume of emails that are being looked at. And again, none of us have a whole lot of details, and that's going to come out in the next couple of weeks, most likely after the election.
Yeah.
I'll
disagree with you a little bit on this. You say it's serious. My response would be, we don't know if it's serious or not, and that's part of the problem. And I sympathize with the FBI director. He was in a really bad situation, really between a rock and a hard place, because there is this sort of I wouldn't call it a tradition exactly, but it's sort of a general practice where the FBI, the Justice Department, tries not to put out things that they think will unduly influence the course of elections. And so that
right.
makes sense. But on the other hand, when you have what may be pertinent information, do you wait until after the election? And then, you know, it was a really tough call, I think, for the FBI director. Either way, he would have come under a lot of criticism. I think ideally it would have been good if there had been more information about what these emails perhaps were, and that's certainly what Hillary Clinton's campaign was calling for. But, you know, it's just a really bad situation. I don't actually think it's going to make a huge difference, because I think for the most part, the impact of Hillary Clinton's emails, which has been one of the main Trump campaign themes for a long time now, is pretty much baked into the numbers. I expect it maybe to give her, you know, a hit of a couple of percent, but given her lead, I don't really see this affecting the overall course of the election. It might cut into her margin of victory a little bit, but honestly, I don't see this as this huge bombshell type of thing, because it's almost certain that we're not going to know a whole lot more until after the election, and that's not due to any kind of skullduggery or anything like that. It just takes time to do a good and careful investigation of these things. And so, you know, it's unfortunate that it came out now, but, you know, and then thinking about it, in the end, though, you know, Hillary Clinton has no one to blame for this but Hillary Clinton. You know, if she hadn't done what she did with the email, which was so clearly a bad idea, none of this would be an issue, and she'd have, I think, a lead of probably 3 or 4% more, and would be totally coasting at this point. But that's not the case, and we've known from the beginning these are both very flawed candidates, and here's where one of Hillary Clinton's great flaws is just coming back to bite her.
Yeah, I agree. I don't see it changing the race fundamentally, for exactly that reason. If this, the story about Hillary Clinton's emails, the story about potential mishandling of classified information, that's been out there for quite a while. And if you're a Hillary supporter, you've already sort of made your peace with that.
Exactly. You know,
So I don't think additional. Now, again, could there be something crazy, smoking gun, stunning, different, not just in volume, but in character and type, that we haven't seen yet? That's possible.
Sure. It seems unlikely.
But we don't know that. And we won't know that until after the election.
Yeah.
No, I think this gives Trump a little bit of a bump. And I think you're seeing that. And plus there's also, you and I both know there is just a weird sort of a way where races tighten towards the end.
Yeah.
That's just kind of the way things fall.
And a lot of this tightening
in most cases.
Yeah. A lot of this tightening is actually Republicans, so to speak, coming home and deciding that
making their peace with Trump. Yeah,
exactly. And you know, I think this would have had a bigger impact had it come sooner in the race, because from what we know about how people make decisions about these things, once people have more or less made up their minds, what they end up doing is they end up looking for ways to support their decision. This is something called confirmation bias. And so the people who are truly going to be affected by this are going to be the undecided voters. And the closer one you get to the election, the fewer of them there are. So in a way, the fact that this came at this point is, you could maybe make an argument, is actually better than if it had come, a month ago when there were a lot more undecided voters.
Yeah.
So
now something that I think is interesting, and we'll have to see how this plays out, but I think it does give a little bit of a lift to Republican senatorial candidates.
Yeah, great point.
Because there's the sense of Hillary still can't be trusted. There needs to be a counterbalance. And even if you don't like Trump, and maybe you're a Republican and you can't stomach voting for Trump, there is still the sense of, I want someone in there who will hold Hillary Clinton accountable. And also these emails tend to cast a wider net, not just on Hillary, but some of on the Democratic apparatus, just because of the other folks that have been involved in the WikiLeaks and so forth. So I think it gives a little bit of a lift to some Republican Senate candidates. Again, my position has always been those races looks like they're kind of being won or lost on their merits rather than on the coattails of the top ballot candidates. But this helps. There was a really interesting piece on 60 Minutes, and yeah, I usually don't watch 60 Minutes. But it was interviewing Ohio voters. And there was one Republican woman who said that she is voting for Hillary Clinton because she can't stand Trump. And she is definitely voting for Rob Portman because she can't stand Hillary Clinton. And again, she sort of realized the ridiculousness of this. She's voting for one candidate, and then she's also voting for another candidate in the hopes that he will block her agenda. But that's just sort of where we are. And I think there's a bit of that that might play in.
Yeah, you know, I am hesitant to agree in a sense, just because there's a lot of anecdotal evidence about that. I'm interested to see if maybe exit polling will perhaps capture some of that. I tend to not believe that voters are as strategic as a lot of pundits sometimes suggest they are. I think what happens a lot of times is those of us who are following the campaign very closely just naturally think in more strategic terms, and we assume a level of sophistication on part of the mass electorate that's not there. But you know, I could be wrong about that. I'm hoping we get some good polling on this that'll give us a better sense of if this in fact is going on, because I think it's a pretty interesting thing. So.
Yep.
All right, well, let's move on from that and talk a little bit about another big surprise, where out west in Oregon, seven armed anti-government protesters headed by Ammon and Ryan Bundy, who took over that federal wildlife refuge a while back, were found not guilty of, being armed anti-government protesters who took over a federal wildlife refuge. Yeah. A surprising verdict. Even the attorneys for the defendants were shocked in what many on the right are calling a victory for individual rights over big government, whereas many on the left are saying it's yet another example of white privilege, and had the protesters come from, say, Black Lives Matter, the result would have been a whole lot different. So Jay, what are your thoughts on this definitely surprising verdict?
Juries do weird things. I've been there. Not as a defendant per se, but and this looks to be sort of a case of a jury nullification type verdict.
Yeah, can you explain that a little bit to listeners, what that means?
Well, I mean, essentially, it's jury is instructed as to what the law is by the judge, and typically they're given instructions in the form of interrogatory, sort of written questions, saying, look, do you find this fact? Do you find that they, you know, were armed carrying these weapons in a federal wildlife refuge? And you check a box, yes or no. Did they do this? Do you make that finding? And these are findings of fact of did this happen? And then there's the instructions say, if you find, you know, if you marked yes in boxes 1, 2, or 3, then you must find the defendants guilty or not guilty. It is, again, just depending on how the instructions are written. But the juries can do weird things, and you can get interrogatories and responses that are not consistent. And I don't know what those questions were in this case. But it sounds to me as if the jury sort of said to itself, look, no harm, no foul. Let's just let this go. I'm as an attorney, that bothers me deeply. So again, I don't know. I haven't seen enough from the actual jury as for how they reached the result they did.
Now, some people are saying that this sets a troubling precedent, and so in future cases, you know, protesters might feel that they can get away with a lot more. But it sounds like to me what you're suggesting is maybe that's not so much the case as just got an odd jury, or maybe it was just a matter of, some on the left are saying, well, it was just a bunch of white guys with guns, and apparently the jury was okay with that, and maybe they wouldn't be okay if they were black guys with guns. What do you think?
That could be. I think that takes it a step too far to say, okay, this is white privilege or racism or something like that, and if they were black, they would have been convicted. Well, they weren't black, and we don't know what would have happened, and it's a different
you can't prove the negative thing.
So I think that's sort of the, you can say, well, look, if if they were Hispanic, they would have, you know, I mean, if they were lesbians, they would have been treated differently or something. I think that's sort of just a silly kind of game. And to me, the bigger point is, did the jury do what was it was supposed to do as it was instructed by the judge? And again, sometimes it's juries just get confused, or it sometimes is just the jury's going to say, hey, no, whatever. I don't think this guy, these people deserve to go to jail
right.
for what they did.
And
that is a I don't know if you want to call it a bug or you want to call it a function of the system. But it's been built into our jury system for forever.
And there's really no recourse once that happens under our system. I mean, once you're found not guilty of those charges, that's pretty much it, regardless of whether or not the jury, you know, disregarded what the law might have actually, you know, been in that case.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to weigh into this because I don't do federal criminal stuff and what the standards to be would be to declare a mistrial or something like that, that might allow them to be retried. But, you know, there's also sometimes you got to look at this. The burden is on the government to prove by clear and convincing evidence what happened. Now, again, to you and me looking at this,
did they impede federal officials from doing their job? Yeah. I mean, yeah, they even, you know, they were proud of it. That was their whole point. And to me, you know, I am absolutely in favor of the right to protest, the right of free expression and so forth. But I, you know, that stops for me when you're actually impeding on other people's rights. And so I think that they have a, you know, a legitimate case to make. I don't really agree with it, but I respect the fact that they can make this case about federal policy, about, you know, about federally owned lands and so forth. That's been a major issue out west for a long time. But the way in which they did that troubles me a lot. And the fact that they were able to essentially get away with protesting in this way, that, you know, that troubles me a lot too.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. And again, I'm not someone who just instinctively would side with the federal government.
No.
But I do side with, you know, law and order. And there's a way, there are ways to protest that are appropriate and there are ways that aren't. And there's even, there's civil disobedience where sometimes, look, you go out there and you break a law to make a point and you get arrested and all right, you pay the consequences. And typically those consequences are fairly minor.
Yeah.
In most of your civil disobedience type situations. And maybe that's how the jury looked at it. I don't know, because I mean, I can't get in their heads, but.
Yeah, and I can respect that. If you say, well, I am breaking the law, I know I'm breaking the law, and I'm doing it to make a point, and I will take my penalty, my punishment, because it's that important to me. But when people.
Well,
go ahead.
You know, and also, for example, here in Cleveland, we had protests, over police issues last year, and you had some people who, you know, stood in the middle of the street and blocked traffic. Those folks were rightfully arrested for, you know, impeding traffic or whatever the municipal ordinance was. They were arrested and they were charged. And I believe, you know, it was probably a first degree misdemeanor and probably $100 fine or something like that. I don't know the exact penalty. But again, it wasn't a years in jail type situation. Which is what these folks would have been facing.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a really good point.
And that's the type of civil disobedience I'm talking about.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because some people suggested that the federal government may have overreached in its charges, and had they tried for something a little bit less, it would have been easier to reach a verdict. And that kind of gets, I think, to sort of a little bit of what you're talking about, is when the jury is faced with this sort of dichotomous choices. Do we either put these people away for a long time, given what the charges are, or do we let them go free? That can be a tough decision, I would expect, for a jury to say, well, you know, they shouldn't have done that, but it's totally not worth them going to jail for years for that.
Right.
You know, yeah. And that's unfortunate. So. All right, well, let's move right along then. Also this week, this is an awfully big week for news. What I thought was going to be one of our lead stories, and it turned out not to be, AT&T announced an $84.5 billion merger with Time Warner, bringing together one of the United States' leading providers of communication services with one of the leading providers of entertainment content. Now, the proposed move drew bipartisan criticism, with Donald Trump saying he'd stop the merger and Hillary Clinton somewhat more cautiously expressing concern. The deal will be examined by the Justice Department's Antitrust Division, which is going to either move to stop the merger or, what I think's more likely, require that this new merged entity allow other companies access to Time Warner's content on equal terms. That's similar to what happened in 2011 when Comcast and NBC Universal merged. So, Jay, are you with Trump and Clinton and even Bernie Sanders on this, or do you think that the merger is a good thing and the federal government shouldn't interfere?
I think we're getting into situations where in some cases, antitrust law hasn't necessarily been before, where you're talking about content and the sort of the pipeline providers. So I think it's right for the FTC to take a look at this. That's their job. Is in any kind of merger of this size, the Justice Department is going to be involved. I think you're right in the sense that we probably end up with some sort of a decision where, Time Warner can't make its content exclusive, and we'll kind of take it from there. But it's a little bit of a new world talking about, because we're talking about different ways of how entertainment is delivered than what it was 20, 30 years ago when sort of the law that we have was set forth. So, and again, keep in mind that the antitrust laws were written in the, biggest one, 1912, I think, at a time to deal with corporate monopolies where corporations bought out others and had absolute monopolies and control. So it's, sometimes you're sort of applying a little bit of a blunt instrument to situations that it wasn't envisioned to be applied to. But that's one of the reasons we have an FTC that can look at these things. And, there's a lot of criteria that they look at, and usually I'm not in favor of bureaucratic administrative agencies, but this is their job, and I think they do an important one. I'm not crazy about politicians jumping out and saying stop the merger just like that. That sort of troubles me as being in sort of an instinctive knee jerk anti business reflex, and I don't think that's warranted. But no, it ought to go through the usual channels and get the appropriate approval.
Well, I thought it was interesting that we got a very similar response from Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, our two big populists over the course of the year, immediately reacting and saying, stop it. And Hillary Clinton, more of a traditional politician, saying, it needs to be looked at. And I think before we get into the optics, the how this plays with the public, I think playing off something you said, traditionally, the Justice Department has focused much more of its concern on what's called horizontal integration or horizontal mergers, which is where you buy a competitor. And this is not a case of a horizontal merger. It's a case of a vertical merger where you buy a supplier, someone in your chain. Right. And traditionally, we've let those things go forward. Now, maybe we're in a slightly different world and so forth. Is this anti-competitive? I think you can make a case to a degree, but it's different than a horizontal merger. And so unless we want to revisit the whole purpose of antitrust law, then, I think this merger has to go forward. I'm sure there'll be some conditions, and I think AT&T and Time Warner are expecting some conditions along the lines of the Comcast NBC Universal thing, and they're fine with that. But looking at the politics of it, people hate their cable providers, right? I mean, AT&T, and I think this is why you saw these quick reactions, because what we know about right. broadband service in the United States is it stinks compared to other advanced countries. I mean, it's overpriced, it's underpowered, except those few areas where maybe Google's been in there and there's some actual competition. We're suffering in this area from an incredible lack of competition. And I think what politicians and the public responding to this, they seem to think that this is related to that. And I would argue it's only really related to that tangentially, because it doesn't get at the fundamental problem is in most markets, if you want to get broadband internet, you don't really have many choices. And that fact means that your incumbent provider, whoever it is, they're not going to feel much of an impetus to improve their service. And I think also when people hear Time Warner, they think Time Warner Cable. But Time Warner Cable is actually right. not part of Time Warner anymore. And so
it is a different organization altogether.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's confusing as well. And so I think there's a lot of confusion, a lot of misinformation or incomplete information. And while I don't think that this merger is going to be good for consumers, I think it's going to be good for AT&T and Time Warner potentially. I don't think that really there's necessarily, based on what I know, a whole lot of grounds to stop it.
Well, you know, on the competitive part of this, and you're exactly right between the horizontal mergers and vertical mergers, the horizontal mergers has much more impact on a company being able to command monopolistic prices and essentially control price. That's the biggest concern of the antitrust laws. So I think you're right there. A vertical merger has much less impact. What it does do, and I think in a lot of cases it can be good because it brings together pieces of the market that let them work together better. And I hate to use the word synergy, but
yeah, please
that's,
don't.
That's what it brings about. And we do have a problem with competitiveness in terms of our cable and broadband communications, but a lot of that dates back, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. As sort of just how the system of our cable TV and so forth grew up in America. And those are, again, it's sort of, there was an infrastructure, there were not monopolies granted and so forth based on technology of those days. And we're dealing with it now where we have really different technologies.
Yeah. And that's certainly part of it. And, you know, looking back, sure, it would be great if maybe we had had the foresight to understand what the internet would be and to treat those pipes as kind of a public resource, a public utility. But that's not, for a lot of reasons, that's not the path that we went down. And some of those reasons are political, and some of them have not a whole lot to do with politics. And unfortunately, now we're in a situation where it's very anti-competitive. And a lot of people are, I think, understandably frustrated with the level of service that they get.
Yeah, but I would just say my hopeful point of this is technology usually wins. You know, if sort of in a matter of technology or regulation, there's going to be a way as we move forward that more competitors, better products are going to get out there. And you see it already with so many people who are, you know, cord cutting. You know, it's just going to continue, and the market will come up with new ways to serve a public that's unhappy.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. In fact, some people may be familiar with right now, most those wireless networks are on what's called 4G, and the 5G is coming, the next generation of wireless technology, and 5G is going to be a whole lot faster, fast enough to the point where it might actually be viable to do wireless broadband type of stuff. We're talking much higher speeds. And right now, you just can't do that sort of thing through wireless, at least not in most places. And so that might be a case where technology all of a sudden makes it possible to deliver the type of service without having the actual fiber lines. At least that would be great. Anything that can encourage more competition, that can lower barriers to entry, I think is going to be pro-consumer and good for people, you know, in the long run. And I certainly hope that comes about.
Amen.
All right. Moving on, some bad healthcare news this week. When the 2017 open enrollment period for Obamacare begins, and that's on November 1st, very soon now, people in mid-level plans will see an increase averaging 25%, according to the federal government. Not only that, but they're likely to have fewer choices as well. Now, the Trump campaign immediately seized on this as yet another example of Democratic failure, blaming Hillary Clinton, of course, with Trump saying that Obamacare is over. Now, on the left, while there was certainly concern, a lot of people view this as a one-time bump due to the end of a federal program that compensated insurers who suffered losses due to insurance pools that have been smaller and less healthy than expected. So what's going on here, Jay? Do you think Obamacare's over? I mean, is this a really big deal or just kind of a blip?
Adam Smith will have his revenge. That's just sort of the, like, this is the market at work. There were artificial incentives in the terms of those subsidies you just talked about that were put into the market to prop it up. And now that they're being pulled out, it is falling apart. I think this will continue to get worse. There's going to have to be some addressing of it. Even Hillary Clinton has acknowledged that. A lot on the, some on the right have said that the whole Obamacare piece was really just a Trojan horse, if you will, for a single payer, that they would put this out there and then it would sort of collapse and be so bad that the only alternative would be we have to move to single payer. I'm not that conspiracy minded, but I think this is something that is it's not working. It's continuing to not work, and not only the price is going up, but healthcare providers, insurers, dropping out of these exchanges at a continuing rate. At some point, you get that what they call death spiral. And we're not there yet, but it becomes increasingly difficult. If you're a young, healthy person, rational choice tends to not to be to buy healthcare.
Exactly. And I think that's the problem. When you set up a system where there can't be any pre-existing conditions, where, in other words, you're telling insurers that they have to take people. And also when you set up a system where people, the penalties that people face, and let's call them what they are, the taxes that people have to face for not enrolling in this are much less than what it would cost for them to actually enroll. Because most of these, especially these lower end plans, they have deductibles that are in the thousands of dollars. And so you're right. Someone who's in their 20s or 30s and is reasonably healthy looks and says, do I really want to pay, a few hundred dollars, I think it's 700 something, I believe in a penalty, or do I want to pay this high monthly premium that also will not give me any benefits until I hit, or not a whole lot of benefits, until I hit thousands of dollars in deductibles, which I don't think I'm going to make. So, of course, they're making right. that decision. And so, to me, the only way to save this, and what they should have done in the beginning, unfortunately, politically, it's non-viable, is to make the penalties, or again, calling them what they are and what the administration would hate for me to say, making the tax a lot higher. Because if there aren't serious consequences for not opting into the system, then of course people are going to opt out. You can't blame people for that. And so that to me is the fundamental design flaw. I do not see legislation being passed that puts greater penalties or greater taxes, whatever you want to call them, on people for not being part of the system, especially given that we're not going to see a Democratic House, certainly. So, and that's again, I think part of the problem is that given the amount of polarization that we have, you had this policy that was passed under a Democratic president and Democratic Congress. And right now, there is very little interest in tweaking it. But especially when we're talking about a huge policy like this, changes are always going to be necessary. And not all of them can be done by regulators, by those agencies. Some of those changes have to be embodied in changes in law. And Congress is not interested in doing that because what for a lot of people on both the left and the right, I would argue, is the important thing for them isn't making this work. It's scoring political points. And I think that's really unfortunate.
Oh, I agree. Agreed. Yeah. Yeah. My potential solution, if I were advising the House Republicans, is maybe put together a bill that allows insurers to get out of some of the mandates of Obamacare, lets them offer policies without those mandates, lets them customize insurance products. Again, let the market work, let them reach out and find out what are those young, healthy people willing to buy and what can we do to get them into a product where, and again, I'm not an insurer, but look, they've got some skin in the game. They're in the pool, helping to offset bigger losses, but they're still getting some sort of value there.
Yeah, I think you're right, because that's another part of Obamacare is where certain benefits are guaranteed. And I think it really puts insurers in a bind, and people like to, people like to argue about, you know, evil insurers and so forth. And I don't really think they're any more evil than any other corporate entities. They, you know, they're trying to make a buck, and this legislation has put a lot of conditions on them. And what they found is that it's difficult for them to make money on this. And so they're pulling out. It's a completely rational thing. And I think fundamentally, and we've talked about this before, I think our healthcare system, the way it's designed through this kind of third-party payment, has just sets up a whole slew of just horrible, horrible incentives. And it would be great to just be able to scrap it and come up with something new. But that's sort of like trying to rebuild a boat when you're at sea. You know, it becomes a really difficult thing to do. Yep. So we kind of have to muddle through. And this is not the healthcare reform that I would have liked to have seen. I actually would be much more in favor of a Medicare for all type of thing. Now that a lot of people on the right would not like that, but you know, this was the result of a lot of compromises that were made with some very powerful interest, and it is a very flawed thing, you know, unfortunately. But I don't think Obamacare is over. I think that we're going to find some way to make it sort of limp along for a while, and kind of. That's sort of how our system seems to work these days, you know?
I think that's probably right. It's not going to just disappear, but I think it will over time be dismantled.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if it'll certainly change kind of incrementally. That's certainly the case. Absolutely. You know, before we get to listener mail, I'd like to thank our new supporter for this week, Luke from Athens, Georgia.
Thank you, Luke.
Luke writes, "My job requires that I drive 8 hours round trip twice a month." Ow. He said, "This podcast has made it much more bearable. The discussions you two have are how I'd love to see politics discussed more often, especially on debate stages. Both of you are very knowledgeable and stern in your beliefs without sounding condescending, and you are both very respectful of each other's stances. You let each other speak and finish your thought without interrupting each other constantly. One question I'd love to see asked on the podcast is, what is a belief or stance that has changed over the course of your life, and what made it change?" And then he ends with, "Keep up the awesome work." I think that's an interesting question, and I think we should answer it, not just because Luke gave us some money, and we certainly appreciate that, but I think it's an interesting question.
That's a good question. Yeah.
To me, it's my answer is pretty obvious, right? I used to be a conservative. I used to be considerably to the right of Jay. And what changed me was graduate.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. I used to think he was nuts.
I was way out there. Yeah, I was pretty radical, calling for rolling back communism and all kinds of other. You know, that was it was a very different world. But anyway, what changed me was graduate school. And I feel that graduate school taught me to look past my preconceptions and yes, my prejudices and see the world like a social scientist. And I think that also happened to turn me into a center-left liberal, basically. So I have changed in a lot of my views, and I think I've changed because I feel like I developed better ways of analyzing and understanding information, and I got more knowledge. So that's sort of my big change over a host of things. What about you, Jay?
Wow, that's tough. You know, because I don't know that I've really had a big change in a policy issue. I've had changes in attitude, I guess, maybe towards some issues. Again, maybe looking at it with a little more depth. I used to, you know, there used to be the sense of the Republican answer or the Democrat answer to everything was spend more government money, and the Republican answer was privatize everything. I am a believer that privatization is a good way to go in a lot of cases, but it's not the solution in every case. And in a lot of cases, it breeds sort of a you know, crony capitalism, where you have some private entity that's just sort of sucking off the teat of the government, and that's no good either. And there's also some things that I think the government itself, the people themselves, should be responsible for. So I have, for example, I have issues with private prisons, which Obama has sort of put the kibosh on and at the federal level, just because that's something that is so important and so fundamental when you're talking about taking away the liberty of people and incarcerating them. I think that's a fundamental system or fundamental piece of what our government has to do, and it's not something you can farm out. If you want to say let's privatize trash collection, super. You know, that kind of thing I think is great.
What's the worst that can happen?
These core functions. I believe so. The other big one, I think, and again, this isn't necessarily a change, fundamental change in policy, but gay marriage. You know, quite honestly, in 1990-something, 1993, 94, when this first surfaced as a national issue, I'd never given it any thought whatsoever. And my initial response was, look, as a conservative, there's sort of the rule of if it doesn't have to change, it must not change. But the more I've grown and thought about it, I think it's a good thing. I think it's good that we have people. I mean, marriage is I think a fundamental building block institution of our society, and we ought to expand it to everyone. Again, I still disagree with the way we got there, and sort of finding a new constitutional right. But I'd say my views have changed on that. I before it would have been, I don't know. And again, maybe an opponent is a strong word, but I wouldn't have been. I think for it. Now I am.
All right. Well, there you go. I think that was a great question. And thanks again, Luke, for your contribution to the show. We really appreciate it. And if you're interested in supporting the show financially, you can do just what Luke did, is go to politicsguys.com and click on either the PayPal or Patreon donation links we've got up there. We would really appreciate it. And of course, if you can help spread the word about the show, we would appreciate that as well. And you can do that by sharing and retweeting our new show posts on Facebook and Twitter, and leaving reviews and ratings of the show on iTunes. All right, let's go into our listener mail for this week. We have a number of people who wrote in, and it's getting to the point where our volume doesn't allow us to get to everything, but if you have written something in, we're going to try our best to include your comment, even if it isn't the very week you sent in your comment. So with that, first we have Kyle from San Jose, California. Kyle writes, "Hey, Mike and Jay, I've been listening to your show since the beginning of the election season, and it's really just such a great show. Thank you for keeping me informed and balanced, and thank you for putting me on to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History." I interviewed Dan Carlin not too long ago. He says, "I am hooked. Thanks again, guys, and keep up the good work."
Great. Thank you, Kyle.
Yeah, and next we have Andrew from, and I told Andrew I was going to not butcher this pronunciation, so let me try. I'm Kelowna in British Columbia, Canada, our neighbor to the north. Andrew writes, "I just wanted to contact you to let you know how happy I have been to find your podcast this election season. I'm a physical therapist in British Columbia, but I spend what would be considered by any rational measure an unhealthy amount of time obsessing over the various curiosities and absurdities of the U.S. political system." God, I know that feeling. With that said, the reason I particularly appreciate your show is that it allows me to live up to a level of accountability for something I ask of others around me. I find myself frequently nagging family and friends, particularly those who live significantly further to my right on the political spectrum, to beware of confirmation bias. It's so very easy in this age of tailored news feeds to be exposed only to news and opinion which serves to reinforce preconceived beliefs and opinions. With that said, even though I'm unlikely to start listening to Alex Jones anytime soon, it's important to me that I hold myself to the same standard. I appreciate you guys because it is amazing to listen to a program where a right-wing voice can explain, in reasonable terms, the positions of a fiscal and social conservative. I rarely agree with Jay, but I value his candor all the same. In Michael,
well, thank you.
Yeah, you know, I share that view. In Michael, it's also refreshing to hear a liberal voice with a sense of pragmatism who is willing to call out and criticize the actions of the left when necessary. And that the two of you are able to do so without simply shouting past one another is both refreshing and far too rare in our modern political discourse. Your podcast is one of six that I listen to regularly, but probably my favorite. Great job, guys, and thank you. So I thought that was really nice.
Thanks.
Yeah. And, you know, it hits on a lot of themes that, you know, we started the show to hit on, that whole idea of a real balance and actually talking to each other instead of past each other. And it's nice to know that seems to be working. So thanks, Andrew. Finally, we have Mike from Lisbon, Connecticut. Mike writes, "Hey, politics guys, I love the show and wish I could make it required listening for all voters and all mainstream and fringe news organization staffers." Yeah, I wish that too, Mike. Like so many other Americans, I've been following this presidential race for what seems like a decade. I could tell you anything you want to know about any of the five remaining candidates and all the failed candidates that dropped out in the primaries, but I barely know anything about the people in the down ballot races for my own state and nothing about any of the referendums I might be expected to vote on. This might be more embarrassing for me, but I know that I'm far from alone. Can you suggest a source or methodology that my fellow listeners and I could use to get a Politics Guys style education so that we can fill out the rest of the ballot in an enlightened way? Thanks, and keep up the great work. And I thought that's an excellent question, especially, obviously, right before the election. And I suppose if I could give people just one recommendation, it would actually be a website recommendation. And the website is ballotpedia.com. That's ballotpedia.com, one word. If you go there, enter in your address, it spits out a sample ballot with all of the candidates that'll be on your actual ballot from president down to local elections. Though, unfortunately, it doesn't list issues or tax levies. What it does, though, is it gives you a decent capsule biography of each candidate and a link to a longer biography with more extensive information. It's the single best, I think, one-stop shop for getting all of that information together in one spot. And so if you haven't checked it already, I'm sure some listeners are familiar with it, please, before the election, do that. I did it just a few days ago to check in, and it taught me a few things about some candidates that were kind of down ballot. So that would be my big recommendation. What about you, Jay?
To me, I think that's good. I think that Ballotpedia gives you info on the your congressional candidates and Senate candidates. Again, so often the information you get is based on what your local press might cover, how much money that campaign has to put out information, and how much the national campaigns jump into that election. For example, if you live in a place where there's a reasonably safe congressional seat, you're not going to hear much about it. There's just not going to be much competition. There's not going to be much news about it because it's going to be a sort of a done deal. But in speaking and going to things like local elections, my biggest recommendation is get involved in your community. This sounds dumb and boring, and sometimes it is. But go to city council meetings and hear what people are talking about and get to know these people. I'm not sure where the nature of the place you live, but it sounds to me like it's not a huge city. And in most places, you can get to know your local leaders and make opinions based on, not just what you hear or read, but look, these are people and work with and so forth. So that would be my, my encouragement is the more you can get involved in your community in whatever form that is, whether it's, church groups, whether it's, civic groups or Rotary Masons, or whether it's a bowling league or whatever. But the more you know about the people and those issues, I think the better informed you're going to be. And that's probably the best way look, our democracy was sort of set up to work that way, in that you were voting on people you knew about and trusted. So,
I think
Ballotpedia. But for local stuff, just go out and meet your elected officers.
I think that's a great recommendation. It's not one that I'm going to even follow a little bit, but I think for people who are, I think that's the best way to do it. And I know you're very involved in that.
Mike, you live within the city of Cincinnati.
Yes,
correct.
That's correct.
It's a little bit more difficult when you live inside a larger city, bigger city limits, and not impossible. But it's easier if you're in a smaller town, suburb, something like that.
For those of you, though, who don't have the time, busy lives and so forth, or you're in a situation maybe a little more like myself, I would say the single best thing you can do for a lot of these down ballot issues and so forth is your local newspaper. Now, this is where, I think we see a big problem, because newspapers are becoming a lot less relevant. The resources have been cut across the board. And so I think that they don't really provide the sort of coverage of these issues, the depth of coverage that you would have seen 10, 20 years ago. And I think that's really an unfortunate thing. So I would encourage people to check out your local newspaper, search out your local newspaper's editorials. They're almost certainly going to be positions on these issues and so forth. That requires a certain amount of effort, not as much as actually going to the meetings. But still, for this kind of stuff, local news is your single best source, and it's a lot worse and a lot less well-informed and well-thought-out and in-depth than it used to be. I don't blame the people running the news divisions. That's just, it's just the nature of the world, unfortunately.
Well, I blame some of them, but go ahead.
Well, and, you know, I think that the thing is what's so regrettable about this is these are the sort of issues that really have this everyday effect. Like if you're being asked to vote on 3 or 4 tax levies, like I think I was in my election, it's been a while. I voted early, like any sane person would do, I think. How do you find out about this? This is the stuff that really affects you in a very real kind of way, in a way that a lot of stuff like arguments about gay marriage in North Carolina, unless you live in North Carolina, you know, don't affect you. And we get so little coverage about that. So I think that's part of what Mike's talking about. And unfortunately, there's just not a great way to do that. And I think that you really need to kind of seek out your local news, as horrible as it might be in some instances, which is going to be, you know, better than nothing. All right. Well, thanks again, Mike, for that comment. And if you have a comment, question, or correction for us, send us an email at politicsguys@gmail.com, or you can message us at the Facebook Politics Guys page. And while we won't read every email on the air, we certainly try to, we will definitely personally respond to every listener email and every Facebook message we get. We're 100% response on that, and we will continue to do that, even though it's getting a little bit hard at times. All right. Well, I think that just about does it for this week, Jay.
I think so.
We're done.
I'm down to 10 days to go.
Yeah, uh-huh. So it should be interesting. All right, well, if you have any thoughts, comments, criticisms, or questions for Ask the Politics Guys, we would love to hear from you. Our email is politicsguys@gmail.com. And actually, big announcement at the end here. I'm going to change from my end spiel. We're rolling out new email. We're moving from Gmail to our own politicsguys.com email. So now, if you want to send us an email, we're going to keep the Gmail account open for a while, our new and improved, very snazzy email is going to be mail@politicsguys.com. And if you want to reach me directly, you can go mike@politicsguys.com. And Jay, you can probably guess what Jay's email address is. J@politicsguys.com. And you can also, of course, leave a voice message for us by calling our listener line at 408-840-3518. And that number is on our website, politicsguys.com. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/politicsguyspage. And we're also on Twitter @politicsguys. And finally, if you're interested in keeping the show going, helping us keep the show going, that is, sharing and retweeting our new show posts and tweets, that really matters a whole lot, as does reviewing the show on iTunes. And finally, if you'd like to support the show financially, you can do that through those PayPal, Patreon links on the website. All right, the Politics Guys will be back next Sunday. We hope you'll join us.